Mrs. Johnson, reel two.
I had a little tiny room where I suppose it was a course of where they hold concerts, I think. I had a little tiny room near a little tiny stage, which was really dreadful. Because down below, the working men's club was still going. You could hear billiard cues going all the time. Up above us was the caretaker's flat, and you heard the patter of little feet all the time. Outside was a school playground with the children playing football and what have you. So I'm afraid we got very, very little sleep there. But again, it was just accepted. I put in myself a letter. I never heard anybody complain. Patients nor men. They didn't complain. Because we saw so much, this was so dreadful. You have no idea the dreadful extent of some of the things. And the very thought that we should complain was dreadful. I mean, we couldn't think about it. And you see, I was engaged by now, and my fiancé was out. He was on Gallipoli. My own brother, who left university at 18, was also fighting in Gallipoli. They never saw one another. They were about a mile apart. They knew one another, but they never met on Gallipoli. It was a terrible thing. And when you got people who'd endured that, I don't know whether you've read the history of Gallipoli, probably you have. It was absolutely terrible. And we've filled up the wards, and would you like to know the sort of thing we did every day?
Yes.
Would that interest you? I just jot it down. I tried to get my mind back to what we did. A sort of routine, as it were. Well, it's the East Eastward Hospital, but it was really all part of the Second Norman General Hospital, you see. And I went to this acute surgical ward. We should have quite 35 to 40 men all the time, I think. Well, now, our sisters began their day at 8 o'clock. That was a concession. The nurses began at 7, we began at 8. And then I used to go up to the ward and get the night nurse's report. When I had the night nurse's report, I used to go round the ward and speak to all the men and see if anyone had died in the night or anything different had happened from when I went off duty. Then we had to go down to matron's office at 9 o'clock to report anything different on the ward or changes of the staff. That would be at 9 o'clock. And then we had 3 operating days a week, which meant the night before the men had to be prepared, have skin prepared, spirits and iodine and so forth, and no breakfast, of course. And a sister, I think it was would be every surgical sister, I think, but certainly I did. I went down to the theatre, it was down, my ward was at the top, with every patient, and I think they liked it, you see. They used to say to them, "You're very frightening for young boys, 18 and 19 years old, to be having their leg off and all this dreadful thing, you know, terrible things he used to have." And he used to say sometimes to me, "Will you be with me, sister?" I say, "Yes, I shall be with you. I'm going with you, and I'm going to stay with you, and I shall come back with you." They used to feel as a little bit sort of somebody was with them that they'd known before, you know. And we did that about 4 mornings a week. Well, now, we had Colonel Walter Thompson, there's another man, brilliant surgeon, and Major Braithwaite, they were the two with whom I worked. They were brilliant surgeons, brilliant men. Well, we were very short of doctors, so some of the civilian, what we call CMPs, civilian medical practitioners, came in to give anaesthetics. And there were not any of the new, very advanced anaesthetics. It was the old-fashioned bag, you may or may not have seen one either, or chloroform as the case might be, and not the same ease with which patients have an anaesthetic now. I mean, you have an anaesthetic, you know very little about it after you've had two injections, so I understand. Fortunately, I haven't had one lately. But it was the old-fashioned way of anaesthesia, which was unpleasant because there was often a lot of vomiting after it. See, that was very disturbing for the patients. Now, the theatre, again, was improvised. Everything was improvised. It had been one long ward. It was divided. You went into the entrance, and on the left-hand side was partitioned off for the X-ray room. Well, I really must mention one particular girl there. See, X-rays were not as advanced nor as safe as they are now. And this girl, her name was Cliff. She was a voluntary St. John's girl. They were not voluntary, they were paid a little salary, but they, St. John's ambulance girls. And she was a deeply religious girl, and her intention was to go into one of these religious orders. And she volunteered to do all the X-ray work, which of course it is rather, it was in those days, rather dangerous for girls. I think now all that is probably altered. But in those days, there was an uncertain element of danger for girls being exposed to X-rays. And this girl, who thought, well, made up her mind, she was going to remain unmarried and devote herself to a religious order, she undertook to do the X-ray work under, of course, the command of another doctor that no one hears of now, Captain Radden, who was an expert radiologist. Anyhow, that was on the right-hand side. Anesthetics we had to give in the corridor. No special room for it, just in the corridor. Then you went through a door into a portion that had been made into a theatre, about three quarters the size of this room. Leading off from it was a little room where the dressings and instruments were sterilised and where the surgeons could scrub up where zinc had been, they brought hot water in. But that was the theatre, compared to the magnificent theatres that I see now. Incomprehensible, you know. But we did it, and we did some marvellous surgery. Absolutely remarkable surgery. Now, there was not any antibiotics in those days. Everything had to be done with antiseptics. Continuous dressings, continuous drainage with tubes, with irrigation into the tubes, in these dreadfully shattered knees to insert various tubes and irrigate them with various antiseptic fluids. A few of which I mentioned, there was a solution that had been under the name of Dakin Carrel. Carrel Dakin solution, it was known as. These are evidently two doctors who perfected this solution, which was very good. We used to irrigate these rooms with it. Terribly painful for the men, dreadful. And then we used a flavine, was another antiseptic, which came very much into force. But chiefly it was cleaning the dressings, putting on new dressings, using iodine, using sterilised, if they were stomach wounds or anything of that sort, we had to put various sterilised gauze with a certain Vaseline thing round it, because the gastric juices used to make the skin so sore all round it. And as I say, chiefly antiseptics, we hadn't any of these antibiotics, penicillin, any of those things that were never even heard of, you see, with nothing of that sort. Hot fermentations, but continuous dressings, really, changing their dressings, keeping them clean, that kind of thing were the most things. Then we began, after this, with the tetanus injections.
But before that,
yes,
in the theatre, what was your role?
My role in the theatre was I took the patient down, I stood with them with the anaesthetic, sometimes have to help with holding the patient down or passing the anaesthetist something. There, to do what was necessary. Then when I got into the theatre, actually, again, I had to do anything that... See, the theatre sister, again, Sister Webster, a wonderful, marvellous woman. Once she was scrubbed up with her gloves on, she couldn't do anything else at all but the instruments in her dressing, nor could the surgeons. Moving the patients, sometimes they had to have a subcutaneous injection, infusion. I have given subcutaneous infusions when they've been in the theatre. On one occasion I had to do well, a man who had been shot through the kidney, was having his kidney removed and was terribly ill. More to be there with the patient in case anything was wanted. Not to take part in the actual operation, because only once, you can only have one sister standing by, and the surgeons, you see, the sister and the surgeon work as a pair. I stood near the anaesthetist in case he wanted anything. Sometimes he'd want something urgently passing, or sometimes they'd need something quickly getting, depending on what the condition was. One would say a useful adjunct in theatre, really, but not the theatre sister. I wasn't in charge of operations, because the theatre sister did that, and she did nothing else but that. She had no ward. Her life was the theatre. And when the operations were over, she was preparing instruments for the next list of operations, you see. Then,
and while you were down in the theatre, then the other nurses in your ward...
I had two staff nurses and two of these St. John's ambulance girls. My ward was divided into two. And in the mornings, we had them in, because they were so busy doing their dressings, all the other men had their dressings to be done. We had different trolleys and they went around these trolleys doing all the dressings. It used to take the whole of the morning. And then you began again in the afternoon and you began again at night. But the morning was the main one, because some dressings would last for so many hours before they'd done again. But there was a staff nurse and one of these St. John's ambulance girls in each ward, and very good girls they were, particularly these St. John's ambulance girls. I had one girl, she was really wonderful. Afterwards she went to train in a London hospital. She liked nursing so much, and she went to train. One or two of them went to train afterwards. Then, by this time, the tetanus was beginning to get less. In fact, to my knowledge, at East Leeds, I think we only had one case, as far as I remember. I can remember one. But when the men came in, you see, any day or night, we could have a convoy coming, and it didn't matter. I don't know quite where I am. I think I've got my little paper wrong. May I just refer to this?
Yes.
The convoys could come in any day or night. And the day staff all had to come on duty when a convoy came in. We used to hear from the orderly room a convoy was expected. You could come in any hour, day or night. So day staff always went back again. And of course these were, terribly heavy days. In the first place, each sister had to go round as carefully as she could to any man who could possibly be moved to a convalescent home. Now, there were several, I should think about 10 convalescent homes all round Leeds. There was Grove Road here, there was Whitkirk, Cookridge, Donningham. I should think about 10. And if a man was at all able to be moved, where they could be under the supervision of trained St. John's ambulance and Red Cross people with a local doctor who would take charge, they had to be removed. So consequently, before a convoy came in, we'd ambulances going out to all these various hospitals and then quickly make up the beds as far as we could. But when it came to such battles, particularly the first battle of the Somme, which I remember very much indeed, with so many in, we'd have two convoys in 24 hours, and with so many in, they were laid on the floors, they were even laid on the corridors, because we couldn't get them into the beds. And we had to make them as comfortable as we could. There was no question of being able to make do them as well as one would have wished in the way of comfort, because one had to just make